how do we know that Jesus Christ was more than just a man? Well, I think one of the things that we must consider has to do with his foreknowledge. In other words, he was able to talk about certain events that were in the future, and he predicted how they would come to pass, and he did so with great accuracy and precision. And I think nowhere is this more obvious than with this particular prophecy that we're going to look at tonight that has to do with the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. Now bear in mind that he predicted this event about 40 years, more or less, before it took place. And actually, we are dealing here not with just one prophecy, but with a series of prophecies that Jesus gave against the Jewish nation. It would be fulfilled in 70 AD when the Roman forces under Titus would besiege the city of Jerusalem, slaughtering and starving the people. And of course, they would utterly destroy the temple itself. Now, our study this evening takes us to the 24th chapter of the book of Matthew. And basically, this is where we are going to stay in this study tonight. And let me just say that Matthew 24 is truly one of the great prophetic chapters in the Bible. The way the chapter opens up is how that Jesus is with his disciples and they are looking the temple over. They are admiring its beauty and the awesome architecture that it involved. And as the disciples are looking upon these buildings, I think Jesus shocks them. Because Jesus said, I want to tell you that there is coming a day when this temple is going to be utterly laid waste. In fact, he said so much so that not even one stone is going to be left standing upon another. Now, I think that we must understand that this was difficult for the disciples to fully comprehend. Because after all, the temple was something that they admired. It was something that was so magnificent unto them, and really it meant everything to them. And by that, I simply mean that their heritage and their religion and their pride as Jews were all tied up in the temple. And so they found it difficult to picture today when this building would no longer be in existence. And so that's the reason why later they went to him in private, the Bible says, and they began to question Jesus about these matters. And notice that they posed to Jesus two questions. And I believe this is very important for us to understand if we're going to properly interpret this chapter. They said, first of all, when shall these things be? That, of course, had to do with the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. And so we understand then that all that is in this chapter, obviously, is not dealing with the second coming of Jesus Christ. Because they said, when shall these things be? And then they said, what shall be the sign of thy coming and the end of the world? Now really, I guess you could say there's two questions here, at least two parts to one question is the way that I would put it. They wanted to know what is the sign of thy coming and the end of the world. Now please notice that Jesus had not said one thing about his coming. And so I think we can only assume tonight that they connected these two events together in their minds. In other words, they thought that this is surely when the temple would be destroyed, when Christ judges the world on that final day. And of course, they were wrong about that. That was a false assumption. But they said, what shall be the sign of thy coming and the end of the world? Now, when they talk about thy coming, I believe that this is best understood in light of Christ's previous teaching unto them. You know, Jesus was very clear about this. He taught his disciples about his going away. He was going to return to the Father, but then of course he was going to return. He was going to come again, and there would be a judgment day. And of course at that time, eternal punishment would be meted out unto the unrighteous. In the 13th chapter of the book of Matthew, and verses 47 through verse 50, Jesus gave the parable of the net. We'll get a little more specific about that in a moment. But Jesus said this as he explained what this parable meant. He said, "So shall it be at the end of the world." And this is something I'm going to emphasize. This expression is used really several times in the Gospel of Matthew. Jesus said, "So shall it be in the end of the world, the angels shall come forth and sever the wicked from among the just." And then, of course, he said they're going to be cast into a furnace of fire. But the point I want to emphasize right here is, in verse 51, now listen to this. He said, "Have you understood all these things? Do you understand what I'm telling you?" And you know what their answer was? They said unto him, "Yea, Lord." I think they were telling the truth. They said, "Yes, we understand what you are telling us." And indeed, they did. They understood that at the second coming of Christ, there would be a day of judgment. This would also be the time when the resurrection would take place. And furthermore, Jesus taught them, and I believe they understood, that all of this would take place at the last day. And in fact, Jesus said the judgment will take place at the last day. In John 12, verse 48, he also taught that the resurrection of the dead would be at the last day. Did they understand that? Well, you know what? Martha did. Because in John 11 and verse 24, concerning her brother Lazarus, she said, "I know that my brother shall rise again in the resurrection at the last day." And so they understood what Jesus had taught them about that. Now listen to me this evening. You talk about a climax. This, I suppose, will be the most climactic event of all time when Jesus comes again. They talked about and they asked him about the end of the world. Actually, this means the consummation of the age is really what he's talking about here. I think that's the best way to interpret it. The consummation of the age. Vine says of the word end that it does not denote a termination, but he says the heading up of events to the appointed climax. In other words, he's talking about all of these things are going to end up to really the great finale, if you please, the great climax when Jesus Christ is going to come again. It will be the consummation of the age. But you know what? The question is, which age? Which age was Jesus talking about? Which age were they referring to? Was it the end or the consummation of the Jewish age, the Mosaic age? Or was he talking about the gospel age? Well, I've already said that this expression is found really several times in the Gospel of Matthew. And as far as I can determine, it is always, now listen, it is always referring to the gospel age. Remember in Matthew 13 and verses 39 through 40, Jesus gave the parable of the tares. And he talked about how there was an enemy who was Satan who sowed his tares among the wheat. And they were told that they were to let them grow together until the time of the harvest. And then the reapers would come along and they would make out the final separation. And Jesus explained what that meant. You know what Jesus said? He said the harvest is the end of the world. The harvest is the consummation of the age. He said the reapers are the angels. And he said that he's going to send forth his angels. And he says that they will gather out of his kingdom all of those things that offend. And of course the wicked are going to be cast into a fiery furnace. Again, surely Jesus there was talking about the judgment day. That's what I believe. That final separation between the just and the unjust that are going to be made, and he described it as the end of the world, the consummation of the age. Listen again. In Matthew 13 and verse 49, he gave the parable of the net. Remember, Jesus said that my kingdom is likened to a net that is cast into the sea, a dragnet, if you please, and all kinds of fishes are drawn in. And he said that when the net becomes full, he says they get on the shore and they begin to sort out the good from the bad. And you know what Jesus said? Jesus said that this had to do, again, with the end of the world. With the consummation of the age. That's what's going to happen again when that final separation is made between the good and the bad. That final separation hasn't been made yet, has it? That's going to be made whenever Jesus Christ comes again. Let me give you one more, and this is an important one. Remember in Matthew 28 and verse 20, Jesus said, "Go and make disciples of all nations. You baptize them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you." Now listen, "And lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world," the consummation of the age. There's that expression again. What was Jesus talking about? Well, it seems obvious to me that he was talking about the gospel age. That is indeed, we'll bring about the last day of this age as we enter into eternity and the final judgment scene takes place. Now then, this is what they were asking Jesus, I believe, about. What will be the sign of thy coming and the end of the world? But let me emphasize again that they posed two distinct questions unto Jesus. They said, "When shall these things be? The temple and Jerusalem being destroyed." And then they posed the second question. And so as a result, Jesus began to deal with this. And I believe this is where we must properly break his teaching up and not get confused as to his answer to these two questions. In verses 4 through 34, he deals with the first question. In other words, the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. While beginning with verse 35, he begins a discussion on the second question, his second coming and the end of the world. And that's the reason why verse 34 has been called the transition verse, because this verse separates the two topics and his discussion concerning those two distinct questions. Notice what he says in verse 34. He says, "Verily I say unto you, that this generation shall not pass till all things be fulfilled." I believe there's two important words in that statement. The first important word that I would point out is the word "this." He said, "This generation." Listen, not my generation, not your generation. He's not talking about something that's going to take place 2,000 years and more from that time. But he said, "This generation," to whom he was speaking. In other words, what he's saying is, everything that I've talked about up to this point is going to be fulfilled within the lifetime of those disciples. "This generation," Thayer says, that this word refers to the whole multitude of men living at the same time. And that's exactly what he's referring to. "This generation," he says, "shall not pass." And then the second key word is the word "all." "This generation shall not pass till all these things." Notice, not some things, not most things. But he said, "until all these things be fulfilled." So I must conclude tonight that everything predicted up to this statement was to be fulfilled during the lifetime of that generation. And so beginning with Matthew 24 and verse 4, Jesus begins to give the signs that they were to look for that would take place whenever the time of the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple would happen. Let me just go ahead and point this out. And that is, when the time came in AD 70 for this event to occur, the early Christians living in Jerusalem were aware of what was going on and got out. Now you think about this. They all got out of the city of Jerusalem. Why? Well, the reason is they had been forewarned. They had the teaching of Jesus Christ. They listened to his warning. And did you know that history records, and this is spectacular when you think about it, we're told there was not one. Think about that. Not one Christian died in the destruction of Jerusalem. In fact, Josephus was a Jewish historian who left us two important works, The Jewish War and Antiquities of the Jews. He lived during the zenith of Roman power, and he was an eyewitness to the final siege of the city of Jerusalem. And you know what Josephus writes? He tells us that there was not a single Christian who perished in that event, and the reason is because they got out. They knew what was coming. They saw the signs. We're going to go through Matthew 24 now and notice the signs that Jesus gave, and they were aware of all of that, and that's why those early Christians were able to escape. So now, if you will, turn with me over to Matthew 24. And I want to begin reading with verse 4. I'm going to read verses 4 and 5. And as quickly as I can, let's go through these signs that Jesus gives that will precede the destruction of Jerusalem. It begins by saying, this is verse 4, "And Jesus answered and said unto them, Take heed that no man deceive you. For many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many." What is Jesus predicting here? He says it's going to be a period of false Christ. And you know what? We know that it certainly was. All you have to do really is read the book of Acts. In chapter 5, verses 33 through verse 37, there it tells of two men who led many people astray. Also, Josephus writes of an Egyptian false prophet who had a following, he says, of 30,000 men. And he tells us that they wandered around from the wilderness, he says, to the Mount of Olives. So when he talks about how there's going to be false Christ, false deliverers, false messiahs during this period of time, that literally fits, doesn't it? Now listen, in verses 6 through 7, he says, "And you shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet." Now listen to that. The end is not yet. "For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in divers places." We've all listened to preachers on television and the radio, and war breaks out here and breaks out there. And we have famines and earthquakes and hurricanes and things like that. And these premillennialists, they say, look at there. Jesus is about to come back because this is a sign that his second coming is about to appear. But you know what? This is talking about that time before the destruction of Jerusalem. In fact, Jesus said these things are going to happen, but listen, he says the end is not yet. The end is not yet. He is predicting that it will be a period of strife and uprisings, and you know what? It certainly was. History records many wars and outbreaks in the Roman Empire from the death of Christ to the fall of Jerusalem. One historian wrote of this period that it was, and I'm quoting, "rich in disasters." He said it was torn by civil struggles. He goes on to say that four emperors fell by the sword, three civil wars, and more foreign wars. So you know what? That fits. what Jesus predicted, didn't it? Not only that, but it was a time of famines and pestilences. You know, there are several famines that are mentioned in the book of Acts. One example is found in chapter 11 and verse 28. We also know that earthquakes abounded during this period, the most famous one occurring at Pompeii on February the 5th, 63 AD. That's about 7 years. 7 years before the destruction of Jerusalem. So again, Jesus is being very specific about these matters, and it comes to pass. Let's read several verses now. In verses 8, and I'm going to read down to verse 13, he said, all of these are the beginning of sorrows, and then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and ye shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then shall many be offended, and shall betray one another, and shall hate one another, and many false prophets shall arise, and shall deceive many, and because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold, but he that shall endure unto the end shall be saved. So what's he predicting here? It's going to be a time of sorrow and persecution. And you know what it was? Again, just read the book of Acts. The apostles were beaten and cast into prison in chapters 5 and 6. Stephen, the first martyr, was killed in chapter 7. A great persecution scatters brethren in Jerusalem in chapter 8. James is beheaded in chapter 12. Also, Jesus said that some would fall away. And we know that happened. We know the Apostle Paul wrote of co-workers who had turned away from the faith. But now listen to what he says here in verse 14. This is an interesting one. He says, and this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. I was listening to a preacher one time on television, and he quoted this passage of scripture, and he said, you know, the time is ready for this to be fulfilled. We've got satellites, we've got the internet, and so we've got the ability to preach the gospel to the entire world. And he said, whenever that happens, then Jesus is ready to come back. Well, I want to tell you this evening, if that's all the Lord's waiting on, he might as well come on. In fact, he should have come a long time ago. Because you know what? That was fulfilled before the destruction of Jerusalem. Paul wrote in Colossians 1 and verse 23, he talks about the hope of the gospel which you have heard, and listen now, which was preached to every creature which is under heaven. He, of course, is talking about the known world at that time. I guess basically the Roman Empire. But Paul, in writing to the Colossians, said, the gospel has been preached to every creature under heaven. Understand that his epistle to the Colossians was written somewhere between AD 61 to AD 63. So something like 7 years before the destruction of Jerusalem, this literally had come to pass. Now listen to what he says in verse 15. He says, when ye therefore see, here's what I want you to get. He's given them these signs, and you're going to see them come to pass. And when you do, I want you to understand what's happening. When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand. You know, this would indeed be a time of abomination in the holy place. Josephus writes of the sad state that the temple fell into prior to the arrival of Titus, the Roman general. Before the destruction of the temple, it became a gathering place for wicked men. And you know what? This is interesting to me. Josephus even uses this language as he writes about it. And I'm quoting now. He talked about the house of God so full of so many abominations. Unquote. Isn't that amazing? He uses the very language that Jesus used. Now, what did Jesus say? He said, when you see this, it is time to get out. It is time to flee the city. Well, listen to what he writes now, or what he says here. And I'm going to read verses 16 through verse 20. He says, then let them which be in Judea flee unto the mountains. I want to ask you tonight, is he talking about you and me? Now, you know what? We've got mountains here, hills and mountains here in Missouri. That's true enough. But we're not in the land of Judea, are we? He's not talking to you and me. He says, those who are in Judea, let him flee to the mountains. Let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. In other words, he says, when you see this happen, and you know, in one of the other accounts, I think it's Luke's account, he said, when you see the armies encompass the city, you get out. You're on the housetop, don't go back and try to get your possessions like we'd be prone to do maybe. You get out of the city. Neither let him which is in the field return back to take his clothes. And woe unto them that are with child and to them that give suck in those days. Why? Because if a woman is expecting a child, or maybe has a small child, she's going to have a hard time, you see, fleeing and getting out. He says, but pray that your flight be not in the winter, neither on the Sabbath day. Pray this doesn't happen in the winter. Why? Well, because of the inclement weather might make it difficult to get out. Pray that it's not on the Sabbath day. Why? Because the gates of the city will be shut or closed on the Sabbath day. In other words, the idea is you need to get out. When you see these things, you need to flee the city just as quickly as you possibly can. But then listen now to what he says in verses 21 and 22. He says, for then shall be great tribulation. Now listen to this. Such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should be no flesh be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. Here he tells us it's going to be a time of great tribulation. And you know what? It was. The Roman soldiers went in and they slew everyone they overtook without mercy. They set fire to the houses where the people fled. They killed entire families, and the whole city ran down with blood. Now, I want you to listen to this. So much so that the blood actually quenched some of the fires that had overtaken the buildings. And did you know that we're told that over 1 million, that's right, you heard me correctly, over 1 million Jews died in the fall of Jerusalem, and there was another 80 or 97,000 who were carried off as slaves. Now you think about that, over 1 million. And notice that he describes this in such drastic terms because he says it will be great tribulation such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, nor no ever shall be. Why do you think he's describing this in this way? You know, you think about it, the modern, if I can put it that way, Holocaust involved a lot more deaths of Jews, what, 4-5 million, something like that? Well, one account I read said it was something like 1,100,000 Jews were killed in the destruction of Jerusalem. Why does he describe it in such drastic terms? Well, I think there was something different. There was something special about this, if I may put it. This was God's judgment upon the Jewish nation because they had rejected their own Messiah. You know what God did? God destroyed the commonwealth or the economy of Israel so that it could never rise again. Do you realize, and this is probably going to be a shocking statement, maybe to somebody in this audience, but certainly to people in the world, but did you know that biblical Israel no longer exists? There is no such thing as biblical Israel today. Now, yes, I understand that over there in the Middle East, there's a nation of Israel. I have no doubt that they are Jews. I have no reason to question that they are descendants of Abraham. But you know what? They're not biblical Israel. Because basically, biblical Israel was a theocracy, where you had a king that God chose and placed over them. And then, of course, it had a religious aspect to it. You had the temple. You had the sacrificial system. You had the Levitical priesthood. None of that exists today and cannot exist and never will exist again. Did you know, as far as I know, that there is not a Jew today who can tell you what tribe he's a member of? How are you going to have the Levitical priesthood unless you know who's of the tribe of Levi? No Jew, as far as I know, can tell you what tribe he's a member of. You know why? The reason is because when they destroyed the temple, all of their genealogical records went with that and were destroyed. And so there's no way that they could have the Day of Atonement. There are no sacrifices that are being offered up unto God today, as the law of Moses demanded. There's no Levitical priesthood. In fact, listen to this. Biblical Judaism no longer exists. Now, I'm sure there's people that say, you know, they're practicing Judaism, or they convert to the Jewish religion, but it's not biblical Judaism. How can it be without the temple? How can it be without the Levitical priesthood, you see? How can it be without these sacrifices being offered unto God? So that's what God did. What God did was he took that out of the way, because this was a source of persecution to the church. And after this period of time, that persecution is going to be gone. But you know what Jesus says? God is going to be watching out for his people. You know, we're told that for some unknown reason, the Roman army withdrew for a time, and every Christian in Jerusalem escaped. Surely that's what he meant when he said, except those days should be shortened, no flesh should be saved, but for the elect's sake. God was watching after his people, and as we've already emphasized, they all escaped to safety. Well, let's continue on. Listen to what he says in verses 23 through 26. Then if any man shall say unto thee, lo, here is Christ, or there, believe it not. For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall sow great signs and wonders, insomuch that if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. Behold, I have told you before. Wherefore, if they shall say unto you, behold, he is in the desert, go not forth. He says, behold, he is in the secret chambers, believe it not. Don't be deceived by false prophets, he's saying. But then he says in verses 27 and 28, for as the lightning cometh out of the east and shineth even unto the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together. Now let me submit unto you that this cannot here be referring to Christ's second coming at the end of the world. We've already explained that. He said everything that I've talked about up to this verse here will be fulfilled in this generation. So it has reference to his coming judgment upon the Jewish nation. You see, this judgment upon the Jewish nation, in a sense, was a coming of the Lord. It was a coming of judgment upon them. I believe, in a very real sense, that really it was a type of the judgment day, showing that God is going to reward all men according to their faithfulness or their unfaithfulness. And he says that it's something that's going to come quickly. He says, as the lightning cometh. You know, in other words, it's going to be swift whenever it happens. Also, the reference to eagles is without doubt figurative language. You know, in the Old Testament, the prophets used the term eagle to describe a foreign nation coming to punish the Jewish nation. I'll give you an example. In Deuteronomy 28 and verse 49, he said, the Lord shall bring a nation against thee from far. And he went on to say, as swift as the eagle flieth. And so this is biblical language. I think God's people, they understood the Old Testament scriptures and the significance of that. You know, there's something else that comes into play, and that is the Romans used the eagle as a symbol of their flags and their banners and so on. And so even in that sense, it fits. Well, let's read now verses 29 through verse 31. And I believe these are some verses now that confuse a lot of people. When he says, immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heaven shall be shaken, and then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory, and he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heaven to the other. Now, you know, that really does sound like an event, like the second coming of Jesus Christ, doesn't it? But as I've already explained, it really isn't referring to that at all. I submit unto you that this is figurative language. Again, the Old Testament often described the fall of monarchs and nations with similar language. I'll give you one example. The fall of Babylon is described this way in Isaiah 13 and verse 10. Now listen, he said, "For the stars of heaven," that's just like what we just read, "and the constellations thereof shall not give their light. The sun shall be darkened in his going forth, and the moon shall not cause her light to shine." You know, there's many more examples we could give. That of Edom in Isaiah 34, verses 4 through 6. And that of Egypt in Ezekiel chapter 32 and verses 7 and 8. And undoubtedly others as well. And so the language of Christ here predicts the fall of the Jewish nation, and the destruction of Jerusalem itself would serve as a sign that Christ is ruling in heaven. Notice it does not say, "Then shall appear the Son of Man in heaven," but rather he says, "You'll see this as a sign of him." In other words, that he is in authority. He's watching out over his people, and he is ruling in heaven. Well, what about verse 31? He says he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. Again, that sounds like what's going to happen when Jesus comes again. But you know, the word angels here, which is from the Greek word angelos, does not always refer to heavenly beings. In fact, it can simply refer to a messenger. You know, we're told that John the Baptist was a man who was a messenger. A man who was a messenger of God in Matthew 11 verse 10. And that's the same word. That word messenger in the Greek is the same word that's sometimes translated angels. So what's the prediction here? I believe this is actually a prediction of the spread of the gospel after the fall of Jerusalem. In other words, it's saying that gospel preachers, messengers, angels, if you please, in that sense, of the first century would go out into all the world, calling people out of darkness into Christ's marvelous light. And this would be accomplished because the problem of Jewish persecution would be behind them. And what did Jesus say? This will be a sign. It will be a sign to everyone that Jesus is true to his word and that he is reigning in heaven. And now listen to verses 32 through verse 34. He says, "Now learn a parable of the fig tree. When his branch is yet tender and putteth forth leaves, you know that summer is nigh." You know, if you know how a fig leaf tree does, you can tell when summer is coming. "So likewise ye, when ye shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the door." When you see these signs I've just given you, you know that it's time to get out of Jerusalem. And then, that's when he says in verse 34, "Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled." And then he says in verse 35, "Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not pass away." I submit unto you, verse 34, as we call it, is the transition verse. He's dealt with the first question. He's given them the signs preceding the destruction of Jerusalem. But now, Jesus is going to deal with the second question. What will be the sign of thy coming and the consummation of the age? Now listen, but that's a word of contrast, isn't it? He says, but of that day. You know, it's interesting. If you go back and read those verses, he talks about days, 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 plural, when he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. But now he's talking about a particular day. He says, but that day. Let me just throw this out. That expression, that day, is sometimes specifically used for the judgment day. Look at Matthew 7, verse 22. Look at 2 Timothy 4 and verse 8. That day is talking about the day of judgment. And Jesus said, but of that day and hour knoweth no man, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. You know what Jesus is actually saying? Now get this. We need to understand this. He gave them the signs that will precede the destruction of Jerusalem. But you know what he's going to say now? When it comes to my second coming, there are no signs. He doesn't give any signs. There are no signs. That's why he's going to emphasize, you need to always be ready. You need to always be prepared, lest you get caught unaware whenever I come again. Now, he does describe the characteristics of that day and time. It's going to be like the days of Noah, he says. Before the flood, they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage. In other words, just living a carefree life until, of course, the flood came and took them all away. He says, then shall two be in the field, the one shall be taken and the other left. Two women shall be grinding at the mill, and the one shall be taken and the other left. In other words, when I come again, some will be ready. And some will not be ready. Some will be prepared and some will not be prepared. Now listen, verse 42. Watch therefore, for you know not what hour your Lord doth come. You don't know when I'm going to come again. Doesn't the Bible say that he's going to come like a thief in the night? And so he begins to emphasize here that we always need to be ready. In fact, he uses that illustration of the thief in verse 43. And in verse 44, he says, therefore be you also ready, for in such an hour as you think not, the Son of Man cometh. In verse 46, he said, blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall he find so doing. In other words, he's saying, you be ready. You always be prepared, because it's going to be a complete surprise whenever I come again on that last day and we have to stand before him in judgment. So he's saying, in regard to that day, the day of judgment, the last day, there are no signs to precede that. And then I want you to get this. And to me, this caps it off. In chapter 25, he says, now listen, he says, then there's got to be a connection. There's got to be a connection between what he's about to teach in chapter 25 and what he has just said about the second coming here in these verses we just went through. He says, then shall the kingdom of heaven be likened unto 10 virgins. We all know the parable of the 10 virgins. We've all read it. We've all heard sermons on it. What is the parable of the 10 virgins about? There's 5 that are wise. There are 5 that are foolish. 5 of them have enough oil in their lamps. 5 of them do not. And when the bridegroom comes, the 5 foolish virgins are left behind because they were not ready. What does the parable of the 10 virgins represent? If it does not represent the second coming of Jesus Christ. Isn't that the way that we've always applied it? That's the point. Don't you see, really, that's the point of this parable of the 10 virgins. You need to always be ready. In fact, in verse 13, he says, this is Matthew 25, watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour wherein the Son of Man cometh. That's why you need to be watching. That's why that you need to always be ready. And so I believe that Jesus here answered these questions. He gave them the signs that answered the first question. When shall these things be? When will the temple be destroyed and Jerusalem be attacked? He dealt with the second question, what will be the sign of thy coming and the end of the world? Basically, his answer is, there are no signs. When it comes to the destruction of Jerusalem, you'll be able to see. When you see this and you see that, when you see the abomination in the holy place, whenever you see the armies surround the city, you know it's time to get out. And isn't it amazing? That's exactly what the Christians in the first century did. They all got out. But when it comes to the second coming, the judgment day, there are no signs that we're going to be able to see that's going to tell us he's about to come. Jesus said, of that day and hour knoweth no man. No man. The angels don't even know. In one place he said, I don't even know. Only the Father knoweth. That ought to settle it for us. Now, how foolish it is when we have men who try to predict the year and sometimes even the day and the hour when Jesus Christ is going to come again.